Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premiere Networks Saturday, August 8th, 2015. This is episode 1209. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by the new Epson Workforce printers powered by Precision Core. Workforce is an award-winning line of all-in-one printers for your home office, small to large business, or corporate work groups. Visit Epson.com to find out more. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. And it's time to talk computers, the internet, cell phones, home theater, digital photography, and all that jazz. 8888, ask Leo, that's the phone number. 888-827-5536. I had to think for a second. That's toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Outside that area, you can, of course, just use Skype and reach us. The website is always good to know, because if you're traveling in the car and you're saying, what did he say? You don't have to write it down. You don't have to pull over. You don't have to risk your life and limb making notes. All you have to do is go to the website, techguylabs.com, and everything will be there free of charge. No sign-up necessary. Privacy Badger. What do you think of when you hear the words Privacy Badger? It's a new plugin, kind of appropriate these days, from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And it blocks spying ads and invisible trackers. There's a version for Chrome and a version for Firefox. And it's kind of cool. It's kind of cool. I installed it. And what it does is it tells you if you go to a site nowadays and you look at the site, you can't see these, but they're all – go to Huffington Post, for instance. You're running Privacy Badger. Let's do that right now. I haven't tried this before. There are all sorts of little doohickeys running on the site. Privacy Badger's counting them up. Looks like there's – wow, I've never seen quite this many. 96 different trackers, 95 different trackers on the page. Those are ad networks. And, you know, some of the trackers are benign or relatively benign. The Huffington Post probably has a tracker that keeps track of how many people visit the site. Google provides something called Google Analytics that do that. But, boy, each one of these has the potential of noting that you are visiting the site to somebody besides the Huffington Post, to a third party, and can query your browser and ask it about you, lots of things, and even set something called a super cookie, that is, figure out exactly who you are and follow you around from site to site. Now, the purpose of this is not to, you know, invade your privacy particularly. The purpose of it is to serve you ads, to track your visits around the net and give you advertising for some of the things you're interested in. I've never seen this. 95 of them. Wow. So what you can do with Privacy Badger is you can lock or block tracking from this site by setting a slider. Now, 95 of them, that's an awful lot to do. But what that will do is then when you go to the Huffington Post from now on, none of these will be able to track you, will be able to see your presence. Now, it raises an interesting ethical question, because the Huffington Post is a free site. It's a magazine that's free to you. And with Privacy Badger, you can kind of take the money out of their pocket, the money they use to pay for your visit with advertising. It's almost as if you were paying somebody to give you a magazine or a newspaper with all the ads cut out. Of course, the point being made by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and these are good people doing, and by the way, a disclaimer, I contribute to them every month, is that, well, the newspaper doesn't know who you are. The newspaper works perfectly well by just selling a newspaper with ads in it and hoping you see the ad, and they don't know much about you unless they do a survey or something. The newspaper doesn't track you. But thanks to technology on the web, we are able to track you and to say if, as you go from the Huffington Post, which is an AOL property, to another property, not AOL, let's say Engadget, well, Engadget's AOL, well, The Verge, a competitor, in fact, that these advertising companies and advertisers will know it's you again. Oh, you're back, Leo. Now you're looking at some other stuff. Privacy Badger has been out for a while, but is now, I think, officially working. And I'm curious what you think about it. I think it's a good idea. Certainly, we have the right to know. By the way, one of the bad things about trackers like this is that they slow you down. When there's 95 trackers on a site, each one of those has to load content, load code from another site, and that can slow you down quite a bit. So this, I think this is a fascinating new area. A lot of people pretty upset about the amount of tracking going on in the net. And really, I think even the publishers are not thrilled about it, but they don't have much choice. Now, let me just go, just out of fairness, to techguylabs.com, because I'm sure we have a few trackers on there. We serve banner ads, so those will be viewed as a tracker. It says we have 8. That's a little less than 95. Some of them are from, in fact, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 are from Google, because we have ad banners served by Google on the Tech Guy Labs. One of them is from Premier Radio Networks. That's the advertising agency. I mean, the company that they are an ad agency, but they're also the company that syndicates this show. And a couple of them, Google Analytics and Quant Serves, are for us. In fact, 4 of the 8 on the Tech Guy Labs site, it says don't track you, don't appear to be tracking you. Some do, though. So you know what? You can turn those off. And in fact, while we do make money on the ads on these sites, this site, we don't have a lot of ads on this site. I think there's 2, maybe not even that many. Oh, it looks like they're blocked. Whoops. I must have turned on a blocker. Let's unblock those. It is, you know, it does defray the costs of the site. One of the ads is what we call a house ad. It's for my own company, Twit. And there's an ad for Carbonite. So that's, and then there's an ad for ZipRecruiter. All 3 advertisers, 2 of the advertisers on this show. And that helps pay for the site, which is a free site. And remember, I've said to you, I don't want your email address. We don't know your email address. I mean, the tracking that they're doing isn't based on your email address. And I don't get your email address. I don't want it. I don't get it. Nor does my company. However, apparently, some of the other ads on here do. What do you think? You know, on the one hand, I feel like we're getting free stuff from Google and Facebook and AOL and lots of other places, and that's how they want us to pay for it, with ads. Seems fair. That's how a newspaper works and a magazine works. On the other hand, maybe advertisers have gone a little bit too far following us around. It's like you got somebody following you around everywhere you go on the web saying, oh, you're interested in that, huh? Have you ever noticed that? Every time I search for a product or service, or even buy a product or service, I'll now see ads for that a lot everywhere I go. I think, wow, they must know what I like. Well, no. No. There is a potential problem, of course. We found out last week that some malicious actors had put bad malware, flash malware, in ads that they had put up on Yahoo. See, some of these networks, like Yahoo, you can buy an ad without any human involvement. You just buy the ad, you put the ad up. And those ads are dangerous. Flash ads can be very dangerous. I have mixed feelings because, of course, everything I do is free to you, including this show. And I make a living through advertising. So I hate the idea of people blocking advertising. On the other hand, I think advertisers have brought this on themselves, haven't they, by going a little too far. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the line to call if you have a thought about this. Good news for Verizon. I guess good news for Verizon users. Verizon joins T-Mobile now in no longer subsidizing phones. How is that good news, Leo? My next iPhone is going to cost $700? Yeah. But it always did. You just didn't know it. We'll talk about that and the new iPhone, which will be coming out in a month when we come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, ask Leo. You a Verizon customer, Kim Schaffer?
I am.
So Verizon has decided not to do, you know how it's been working up to now. And by the way, as a current customer, it won't change for you unless you ask Verizon to change it. But you, when you first became a Verizon customer, they subsidized the phone. A new iPhone cost $200. But you had a 2-year contract.
I'm in the middle of that right now.
Yeah,
I'm waiting
until
September.
Well, is this better for you or not? You tell me.
Okay.
No more contract. Okay. Period. Existing customers can keep their current plans. We don't know what that means, though. There are some restrictions. But under the new plans, which take effect August 13th, prices for voice, text, and data will drop about $20 a month. But you will either pay full price for the phone. Do you know how much your iPhone costs? For reals?
Like $700.
Yeah, $650 or more. That's true of most high-end phones. Or you'll be able to spread the payments out over 2 years, which will in effect give you a 2-year contract.
Is that the edge? Because that's what they've been talking
about. It's edge everywhere, basically. That's right. T-Mobile's been doing this too. They'll also be streamlining their data plans. There can only be 4 data plans ranging from small to extra large. Small is a gigabyte a month. Extra large is 12 gigabytes a month. That's a big change.
Well, what tweaked me was 2 years ago when I got my new phone, they took away my grandfathered...
they don't like unlimited data. They don't like that.
So then I went down to 2 gigs, and that's not very much.
People have been able to keep their unlimited data by buying the phone outright.
Right.
And that's what you're going to end up doing from now on. The good news is there's some really good low-price phones out there, not iPhones.
I don't want that.
Nobody's going to cut the price on an iPhone. You could buy an old iPhone. You could buy, like, last year's iPhone or 2 years ago.
I still have that HTC One.
Yeah. You didn't like that, did you?
Well, no, it's fine. It just has no battery life. Yeah. I have it for another month or two.
Yeah. You're going to... exactly 1 month from today, supposedly, according to rumors, Apple will announce the next iPhone.
That's
so it's perfect timing for you.
Yeah.
But get ready, because there's going to be some sticker shock. All of a sudden, people who thought phones were $200 are going to find out they're not. They're a lot more. But no 2-year contract. I don't know.
I'm not sure what to think about that.
I don't mind seeing the contracts go away because it's such a strange thing to say, you have to pay us if you want to stop doing business with us.
Right.
Imagine if my dry cleaner gave me a bag to put the clothes in. Oh, I'm sorry. You have to continue to use us for the next 2 years to pay for that bag, or you're going to pay us $100 to leave. Nobody would do that.
Yeah.
It's kind of what the phone company's doing. I mean... I think they're more than making up the price of the phone, so I think this is better. Unfortunately, the Moto G, which is my current low-cost phone, mine comes Tuesday, $200, but it doesn't work on Verizon. 8888, ask Leo, you've been lining up phone calls, Kim Schaffer.
Yes.
Who should I talk to first?
Barry in Tustin has a Note 4. He somehow locked himself out of it.
Uh-oh.
He's being told the only way to get back in is wiping any of its data, but he has no backup. So he wants to know if you have any other
suggestions.
Poor Barry.
Hi, Barry.
Help, please.
That's terrible. So you have a Samsung Galaxy Note 4. Nice phone.
Yeah, I like it.
Remember your password? Is that what you did?
No, I was using an app that required a screen lock, so I used a pattern, and that required a backup password, which I didn't think I'd ever need. My wife used the pattern until she exhausted it.
Uh-oh, she used all 10 tries.
Yeah.
And it says now, well, you better give us a backup password.
So I, after exhausting most of them and talking to Samsung and to Verizon... where I was told by both that they could do a hard reset, which would lose my data.
Right.
I figured it out, and it opened. It looked like I had the option to change the password, which I did to something much simpler. And now it won't take either of them.
You were so close.
I was so close.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Four tries left, but it definitely won't take either one of them.
Oh, and you're sure that you know what the second password was?
Oh, yes. I know what both of them are very clearly, and I tried them each twice because I'm a bit dyslexic. So they're on the internet and YouTube, there's things that require rooting that says they can do it. But I don't know anything about that other than...
There's one little tiny hope. Did you ever set up the Android Device Manager?
This is from... I didn't, but I've looked at that, and it says I can lock it and change it.
Yeah, you could change the password remotely with the Android Device Manager. This is a free program from Google, which next time you will put on your phone.
I absolutely will.
It's useful for a couple of reasons. I'm looking at mine. It tells me where my device is. I can ring it. I can erase it if bad guys got it. And I can lock it. And I can your current lock screen will be replaced with a password lock. And it says new password. It doesn't say you have to know the old password.
Yeah, I did ring it. But I didn't want to attempt trying to replace the password without talking to you first.
So you do have Android Device Manager.
If it won't ring unless it's already set up, then I must have set it up.
Yeah. Nice. So I've never used this. So really what you're calling is saying, what's going to happen when I press that new lock screen password thing?
Is that just going to complicate my already?
I'm hoping. Anybody use this in the chat room? I'm hoping that what will happen is it will overwrite the other bad passwords and put. I mean, what you really. You don't. There's no harm here because at this point, your only other option is to wipe the phone, right? You understand why they do this. In case somebody. You lost your phone and you think that whoever has it knows your password. You can enter a new password that only you know and push it to the phone. In other words, lock the phone. So I would try this. Somebody in the chat room says, yeah, I've tried it. Works fine.
I will try it.
So don't blame me. Blame Ethan Pilot 787. Hey, he's a 787 pilot. He's got to be trustworthy. This is a really, you know, this is exactly why Google started putting this device, this app on phones. And I guess it comes on your Note 4. And at some point, you set it up.
I hope so.
Oh, I hope so, too.
It makes sense. But what I tried to tell Verizon and Samsung is it's got to be in there somewhere in order for me to type it in and the phone to recognize it.
One would think.
And that somewhere has got to be accessible.
No. You don't want it to be because otherwise law enforcement and others could crack the phone. So of late, due to our paranoia... Android has become much more secure, and there is no way, everybody says, maybe they're lying, but everybody says there's no way for us to recover that. I think your last best bet is Android Device Manager, and if you don't have it on your Android device now, put it on there. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy. He's Scott Wilkinson, the home theater guru. You hear him each and every week on the Home Theater Geeks podcast at twit.tv/HTG. You also can see his lovely works at the AVS Forum. He's editor-in-chief there, avsforum.com. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Leo. How's it going?
It's going great.
Good deal.
You got a question from a viewer, a listener?
Yeah, a listener. Yes, indeed. Lance Pellissier says, I don't think 4K streaming will ever take over 4K discs. Since you're talking about videos that are 1 gigabyte per minute, and we in the U.S. anyway, well, Netflix requires or says that it's ideal if you're going to stream 4K that you need 15 megabits per second downstream bandwidth. And I've done some research on this, and the median downstream bandwidth in the U.S. anyway is way less than that. So, and he says, even if you have that, you know, you're talking a gigabyte a minute, roughly, and a 2-hour movie, if you have 150 gigabyte data cap, which a lot of people do, or maybe 200, you might be able to stream one 4K movie or maybe two.
Right.
per month.
Well, he's got a good point, and let's add more, which is that the streaming 4K is not nearly as good.
Yes.
As a stream. And you know what? You can replace this in every respect with HD.
Yeah.
Frankly, streaming HD on Netflix isn't as good as a Blu-ray disc.
Correct. In fact, I've heard it said a number of times that 4K streams they look just about as good as an HD Blu-ray.
Right. Right.
So, you know, you're exactly right. They compress the heck out of those streams in order to be able to get them to you in a reasonable manner. And discs, certainly, they have compression as well, but not nearly as much. And you made a good point off the air. You said, we don't even have 4K discs yet.
This is a little premature. Just only a touch.
Only slightly, though. Literally only very slightly. This spring, the Blu-ray Disc Association finalized the specifications for Ultra HD Blu-ray. The official name of it is Ultra HD Blu-ray, 4K Blu-ray, colloquially.
Right.
And so this summer, now they're starting to license that specification to manufacturers to make players and to studios to make discs. And we should see them by the end of this year. I'm a little less optimistic than some of the estimates I've heard. They say, we'll have them, you know, easily by Christmas time, so you can buy them for the holiday shopping season. I'm not so convinced of that. We'll see prototypes possibly at CEDIA, which is the Custom Electronics Design and Installation Association. That's the second biggest show of the year for me. It's in October this year. We'll certainly see product at CES next January.
May be moot because how many movie studios have signed up to put out discs in UHD?
In UHD. I don't know the answer.
My thought on that is, of course, look, nobody's denying that physical media is going to look better than streaming media, period.
Yes, correct.
Period. The problem is, though, that movie companies like streaming media because it's harder to pirate. And I think they're very worried about physical media and piracy.
Right, because every single disc has already been pirated. Every disc format has already been pirated. Right.
I could copy any disc you send me. Yeah. That's the problem. As soon as you get – it's just inherent in the – there's no way to make a uncrackable physical medium.
Nope.
Because in order to play it back, the player has to have the key. So it could be locked, which it is. It's encrypted and protected. But the key resides in the memory of the player. So you can always – and hackers are good at this, extract the key and figure it out and distribute it. In fact, that's what they did with Blu-ray. They said, okay, well, we'll have revocable keys. So if it does get out, well, then we can change the keys. But they don't do that because in order for that to work, every Blu-ray player would have to be online and update the keys. And it would all of a sudden you'd get thousands or millions of customers saying, my Blu-rays don't play. It would be a mess.
Yep, exactly right.
So the movie companies, I think, we'll see. I mean, there's no incentive for them right now because there's as you pointed out, no players. There will
be no players yet.
No TVs. Nope. And even when the players and TVs come out, it's going to be a tiny fraction of the total audience.
There are TVs out there, plenty of them.
Right. Of course, what am I saying?
There are 4K TVs all over the place.
Right.
That has been part of the problem with this whole move to 4K or UHD is that the TV makers, I think, kind of jumped the gun. And they just all of a sudden started pouring out these 4K TVs without some of these other elements that you and I have talked about on the show before, like high dynamic range, wide color gamut, that sort of thing.
I feel like the movie industry is not interested. And most users can't tell don't care that much. It's the video files that are buying Blu-ray discs still. Is there anywhere you could buy physical discs in your neighborhood?
Sure, Best Buy. Although I will admit that when I go in there, and I do go in there
fewer
and fewer. Fry's Electronics, I don't know if they extend beyond California.
Our last video store went out of business
last couple weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, maybe people will say, well, that's because you could buy it online. Amazon's doing really well.
Sure. Sure, that may very well be.
I think all the movement is towards streaming. Even though it will never be as good, I think most people don't care.
It will never be as good, and there is a this guy Lance makes the point too. I like having the media itself. There's something in human nature about enjoying holding a physical thing.
Steve Jobs used to say that about music. That's why Apple never did streaming till now.
Until now.
Because fewer and fewer people are buying music.
Well, yeah, and then there's the issue of clutter. You know, I mean, I myself am trying to sort of declutter my home now, and I've got a lot of CDs that I've already ripped.
A lot to be said for convenience, too, right?
The
fact that you can watch a movie just by pushing a button, not going to the store, but just by pushing a button, and it downloads, and you watch it.
Yep, yep.
So
but
I just
if you have a data cap, if you have a data cap, you know.
But that's data caps. I don't know who these people are, but there's. That's another small minority, I think.
Is it really?
Yeah.
So most plans that you can get at home for
Comcast
for
tried
internet?
A data cap, a 250 gig a month data cap, and abandoned it.
Oh, they abandoned it. Yeah. Okay. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Maybe if most people don't have data caps, then it's no big deal.
People who live in rural areas, people who have satellite television or satellite internet, some of those people do have caps. Certainly people in other countries do, but talking about the U.S., you know, I don't know what the number is, but I think it's a small minority. And again, remember, the overriding concern for TV and motion picture companies is piracy. Mm-hmm. So what they're going to do, I think they're going to do, as long as they continue to make money at it, which they will.
Yeah.
They're just going to continue to stream that stuff, and they're never going to put it out on disc. I hope they do. Maybe it'll be a small, you know, it might be like the Criterion Collection, a small video file.
Right. Or even LPs these days, which appeal to the audiophile crowd.
Right.
And it's enjoying some resurgence among young people also. But, you know, it's a relatively small market compared to downloading or streaming audio music.
I'm told UVerse has a data cap, which is interesting. That's an AT&T.
That's interesting.
For their 150 gigs a month for DSL, 250 gigs a month for internet up to 45 megabits, a terabyte a month. I'm sorry, not bits, bytes in all those cases for gigapower. Mm-hmm. But they don't enforce them, according to. So I
don't. There's that.
You know, I think if you start enforcing it, you'd hear from people. People are using more and more all the time. Hey, yep. Scott Wilkinson, avsforum.com, twit.tv/HTG. We'll talk to you next week. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Now, Beatmaster in the chat room is saying something interesting. Luckily, you aren't in the UK or the CD ripping would be illegal soon. I can't imagine how that could possibly be because, at least in this country, it's not illegal to rip CDs because they're not copy protected. That apparently is what makes the difference. Ripping DVDs and Blu-rays, that's technically illegal. Now, a lot of people do it and they put them on their servers and their NAS drives and so on. But CDs have always been legal because they're not copy protected. So I can't quite understand how in the UK they would make that illegal. And if they did, how they would enforce it. That's quite a good question. I mean, are they going to send people to your house and say, what have you got on your computer there? Thanks, everybody, for your congratulations. Yes, it's a wonderful thing to have come this far and with my wonderful wife, Joanna, Mrs. Scott, in the chat room when she's here. You will know her as that name. Thank you, Rusty Bones and Terry Kay and everybody. Yeah, it's a momentous occasion. And we don't have a lot of time, unfortunately. The circumstances are that we just don't have, you know, weeks to go spend. I wish we did. Mike B here on another topic says, if you're viewing Netflix where you are on their Open Connect network, the quality is amazing, comparable to Blu-ray. Well, I didn't know that. I'll have to check that out. That's pretty interesting. Open Connect network. I've never heard of that, so I don't know. Sybil, congratulations to you. Your 44th anniversary is in September. Holy smokes, that's really something. Rusty Bones, yes, there are many harmonic convergences in Ojai. Yep, exactly. Web7995, did you see Shaun the Sheep? Not yet. I do want to see that. I love the claymation that comes out of that studio. Absolutely. The movies I saw this week, I saw Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation. Really great. I really enjoyed that one. I like the Mission Impossible franchise. And that one is a great one. I saw it twice, actually. Once in standard dynamic range and once in high dynamic range at the Dolby Cinema at Prime at the Burbank 16. And I have to say I was a little disappointed in the high dynamic range. The movie that really captured my attention in high dynamic range, unfortunately, was Pixels.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo. That's the number if you want to talk high tech. Like Charisse in Lancaster, California. Hi, Charisse.
Right there.
Hey,
hi,
right
Leo,
there.
How are you?
was your husband holding on?
Yeah. He's sitting right here.
You made him do the work, right? Hold this. What can I do for you, Charisse?
I wanted to know about our Cortana on Windows 8. He just got it, and he's having trouble making her understand him, or understand him.
Yeah. One of the things I've noticed is that some microphones, in fact, Cortana will even tell you this, are not Cortana ready. Cortana is the new feature in Windows 10 that lets you talk to your computer, ask it stuff, say, remember to get my wife flowers next week, things like that. And you certainly want to make sure that that's working, don't you? So you find that, how is he activating Cortana? Is he clicking the microphone or hitting Windows C, or what is he doing?
He's been clicking the microphone.
Okay. And what kind of computer? Is it an older computer, a newer computer? Does he have a microphone?
He has a microphone.
Okay.
It's a webcam microphone.
Ah, that's probably part of the problem. So is it just not doing a great job of understanding what he's saying, or is it?
It gets about 40% of the time.
Yeah, that's not great, is it?
No.
So let me just try this here just to see how good Cortana. I'm going to hit Windows C. That's the shortcut. What time is it in Peru? And, yeah, she got that right. Now this is a Dell laptop. It came with Windows 8, not Windows 10. And it did have to have, I noticed, a special driver installed for the microphone. My guess is he might be distant from the microphone. You know, if it's a webcam.
How close does he need to be?
Well, not too close either. That's the other thing. Sometimes people shout at these things, and they distort the microphone. So he might want to try in different voices, different levels of talking to Cortana. Maybe talk gently to Cortana. Sometimes I notice this, that people will yell at Siri and the other voice assistants. And what my wife does this. She'll take the phone and put it to her mouth and say, "Hey, Siri, what time is it?" And, of course, if you think about it, what Siri's getting, so you, I wish there was some way to listen back to what Cortana is hearing, because that would give you some information. You can also go into the mic settings and perhaps turn it up or turn it down. This is so new that we don't yet have a lot of information about Cortana, but it would be really nice to improve the Cortana's voice recognition with training, for instance. Some other, you might be aware of other systems that let you train voice recognition.
Right.
I do believe in the settings, one of the things that got people up in arms was that Cortana will send your speech samples back to the home office. And one hopes that at that point the home office is improving Cortana. Make sure it's got set for the right. Does your husband have accented speech? Is he from Great Britain? Does he speak with
No, not at all.
An upper-class accent? Because accents, Cortana is a little notorious for having trouble with accents.
Okay.
I would just say, don't speak too slowly. Cortana wants you to speak kind of normally, like I'm speaking. Okay. Speak clearly. And I would play with the settings and play with different tones of voices and try getting closer or farther from the microphone. You don't want to be too close because it didn't overmodulate you. And Cortana,
he's about 2.5 feet away.
2.5 feet might be too far. Because it's on the screen, right?
Right.
Yeah.
It's a Logitech webcam.
Yeah, check the volume. Cortana, Cortana does get better with time. Actually, somebody's reminding me, and I think I did do this. You can train Cortana by reading some sentences to it. That might help, too. Look at the Cortana settings. I like Cortana. I really like the idea of speaking, but sometimes I feel kind of dopey if there's other people in the room. Like, you don't want to, you only want to do it when you're alone. And that's why I'm curious about Microsoft's strategy, because when you have your phone, it's not such a big deal on a phone. It's tough to speak to your phone. People are used to that. You're talking to your phone anyway for other reasons. But I'm wondering how Cortana on the desktop's going to work for people. Like, will people in a crowded office all start talking at once to their computer? Look in the Cortana settings. There's a training settings. That might make it better. Look in the mixer. Make sure the levels are good. And maybe record something. You know, do you have Skype on the machine? You can do the Skype test, and it'll tell you. You'll hear at least what it sounds like. That'll give you some idea.
We have Skype.
Yeah, the Skype call testing service. The phone number for it is Echo123, but it's also in the Skype audio settings. You're using the same microphones for Skype, so you could at least try it that way and hear what it sounds like.
Well, that's a good idea.
Yeah, just to get some idea. If he's really far, you know, when you're far from a microphone, you get a lot of room noise and maybe you're not as loud. When you're too close to a microphone, it overmodulates. You know, there's a sweet spot. But my experience with Cortana is, and I have, of course, perfect enunciation, and I speak in a bland mid-Atlantic accent. Cortana understands everything I say to her. But you do want to speak more normally. Try training it.
Okay, we'll try it.
What's
can I ask one more question?
Sure.
He also has a Vista machine, and he wants to know why he's able to upgrade to Windows 10 when before he couldn't.
Wait a minute. They said, really?
Yeah.
You got the offer to upgrade? Well, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. Do it.
No, not the offer upgrade. He could pay for it, but before... It was an HP. It's a store-bought computer.
Yeah.
And they told him he could not upgrade it, and now he's able to.
Well, good news. Microsoft really wants every single person using Windows to be using Windows 10. So they probably – I would imagine – I don't know why you weren't able to upgrade, but I would guess it is there was some hardware on that machine that there weren't drivers for in later versions of Windows. But the good news – you know, Vista, wow. The good news is Microsoft wants everybody to run Windows 10, so I would guess that they're doing a better job of compatibility. So if the compatibility checker and you ran it on your machine says, yeah, you're eligible, you got to do that, okay? Run the compatibility checker. If it says, yeah, it works, then I'd go for it. $50, good deal.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, he's going to go for it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Take care.
You're welcome. Nice to talk to you, Charisse. You don't get the free upgrade, but $50 is that's a good deal. And the thing about what's happened that's interesting in computers, for a long time, you know, the recommendation was, you can only go a few versions, upgrade to a few versions. At some point, your computer's just not going to have enough memory or enough hard drive. But computers for the last 10 years have been pretty powerful. So any computer that was purchased in, let's say, the last 10 years is probably going to be upgradable. It might even run better. I've heard people say, I've been able to upgrade. I don't know how they were doing that. For free, I mean. I'm pretty sure you have to pay. So do run the Windows compatibility checker, by the way, before you install Windows 10. Microsoft is not saying every computer can be upgraded. So make sure you run the compatibility checker. And then if it says okay. Our website is techguylabs.com. We've got lots more calls to come. Don't you go anywhere. Give us a ring if you haven't. If you've got a question, a comment, a suggestion. 8888-ASK-LEO, the number. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Okay. You have 1 year to take advantage of the upgrade. Once you upgrade, you are a Windows 10 owner for life. It is not that it will only be a year of Windows 10. That's very confusing, I understand. But it is very. But Microsoft has been asked again and again, and they finally said yes. You have 1 year to upgrade for free Windows 7 or 8. Once you upgrade to Windows 10, it is a Windows 10 machine. It is licensed. It is activated. And it's good for the life of the machine. By the way, it is tied to the machine. Scott Wilkinson is tied to his machine, so we should probably let him do his bit.
I am tied to my machine.
While I wander off.
Yes, go take a break.
I will. Thank you.
Been having a conversation in the chat room with Web7995, who asked me about 4K Blu-ray players. And we were talking about this earlier. And I said, well, we'll see them later this year. Maybe at Cedia, maybe at CES. And he said, well, check this out. And here it is, something on the Home Shopping Network. Today's special. It is, let me find it here, a Samsung Wi-Fi 4K upscaling Blu-ray player. And that is the crux of the matter here. It is a regular Blu-ray player that will play regular Blu-rays, which have a resolution of 1080p, 1920 by 1080, but then also upscales to Ultra HD resolution, 3840 by 2160. And so that's what that is. It's not a true 4K player. It upscales. And so then the question becomes, should you have the player upscale or the TV? Now, presumably, I mean, the only reason that you would get this and the only thing it's good for is if you have a 4K TV already. And so the question is, where do you do the upscaling? This was also true in the days of HD when you had DVD players that upscaled to HD. And the question is, well, who does the better job of that, the player or the TV? Generally speaking, I would say the TV probably does the better job because, for example, this Blu-ray player is $120. So I can't imagine that they would put a really good scaler in there. The TV, which probably costs several hundred at least, if not a thousand or two, probably has a better upscaler in it. And the other thing to consider, well, it kind of doesn't matter. If you have a 4K TV, it's whatever you send it is going to be upscaled. There's sort of no way around it. What I was going to say was whenever you upscale something, that is, take the native pixel array and expand it, make it larger, you're adding in a bunch of information that wasn't in the original signal. So sometimes that will look good. Sometimes that won't look so good. It could easily do something called softening the picture, which is making it look a little, well, not sharp. Opposite of sharp, soft. So that's what we're talking about here is upscaling, which is all you can do right now. Like I said, true 4K Blu-rays and true 4K Blu-ray players, we should see by the end of the year, I think. good question, Tim Elliott. How much shorter will the playing time be on a 4K disc? Great question, actually. Current Blu-rays are 50 gigabytes. And you can put a 2-hour movie plus on them, and that's a dual-layer disc. Ultra HD Blu-ray discs will come in two capacities. One is 100 gigabytes, and one is 166 gigabytes. And so that you might think, oh, well, you get twice the amount of time or more, except that there's at least twice as much information, if not more. Technically, you know, with a Ultra HD signal, there are four times as many pixels. So that's four times as much information. Now, the compression that they use for Ultra HD Blu-ray and other things is what's called H.265 or HEVC, which is more efficient by up to 50% compared to the compression that they use for Blu-ray, which is H.264 or AVC. So a 50% increase in efficiency, but four times as much data at least, means that you're still going to have more data on that disc. My guess is that you'll probably, obviously they need to be able to fit a 2-hour movie onto a disc. And so that's what I think that's what you're going to end up getting. They might also have to crank up the amount of compression a little more than they do for Blu-ray. So that would be another factor to think about. Let's see. What else have we got here? Happy to talk to anybody about just about anything. Lawn Dog, yes, I am using a Mac. Somebody was talking in the chat room. Oh, it's already scrolled past my my capacity to see it here. Somebody in the chat room remind me. It was called Open Connect for Netflix, which they say looked really good, but it's only available from certain ISPs, Comcast being one of them, as I recall. Beatmaster says, a 4K UHD upscaling Blu-ray player has its advantages. The web apps on the player will be high-res too then. I'm not 100% sure about that, to tell you the truth. I do know that basically, for the most part, the only way to get 4K streaming at this point is the app inside the TV. There are no other, I don't think any Blu-ray players have 4K streaming apps. So they will be streaming 1080p or less. And I don't know whether the Blu-ray player would upscale that or whether it would send it directly to the TV and have the TV upscale it. At this moment, except for the Sony FMPX10 server, the only place to stream 4K is from the TV itself. Why do stations still pander to the lowest common denominator with 4x3 CRT TVs and not show 16x9 movies? Really hate when the credits switch from 16x9 to 4x3. Yeah, I kind of do too. This is a bugaboo for sure, and it has to do with what the carriers do. There are some channels that I get on my cable system that are all stretched and weird, and there's nothing I can do about it. So it's really unfortunate. 60 seconds left. Pasilin, I can't pronounce your screen name there, but do you recommend Channel Master or anything for the cord cutting idea? Channel Master is great for over the air recording, DVR, as is TiVo. So those two are the ones I definitely recommend for that in terms of over the air.
All right, Scott.
Leo, thanks so much.
Have a great anniversary. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
You. 2 weeks.
Sounds wonderful. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers and the internet, home theater, digital photography, and all that jazz. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the number. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. You can use Skype to reach us if you're not in that area. TechGuyLabs.com is the website, a good place to go if you want to follow up on stuff you hear on the show. We put it all there. Did you see the stock market punished the cable companies? Viacom and other stocks went down. Why? Because it turns out cord cutting is accelerating faster than anybody thought. You know what cord cutting is? You've heard the phrase probably. We've talked about it a little bit. Cord cutting is the idea that you don't use the cable to get your television anymore. You use the internet. And, you sacrifice a little bit doing that, of course. But if you're lucky enough to live in a metropolitan area or near enough a metropolitan area that you can get your local stations from an antenna over the air or OTA, then you really don't miss anything. You'll get all the big events like the Academy Awards and the Super Bowl. You can get them on your local channels. And then you get your movies and the stuff that you would pay a cable subscription for over the internet, thanks to Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and all of these great services now that just stream stuff to you. And increasingly, even people who don't live close enough to have an over-the-air signal are cord cutting as well. There's a bigger issue. There's a big train coming down the tunnel that I think the networks are starting to realize, which is that people under 25 don't watch TV at all. I look at the younger people, college kids, my kids. My daughter's 23. My son's 21. My daughter is, 23. She's like the last generation. She doesn't watch live television. I haven't ever seen her do that, unless we made her when she was younger. She watches Netflix. She watches streaming. Like, if she wants to watch Friends, she watches it on Netflix. She watches Louis C.K. on Netflix. But my son doesn't even watch that. He's 20. He'll be 21 in a couple of weeks. He doesn't even watch that. It's YouTube. It's YouTube. And YouTube's numbers are going up and up and up. The last annual or quarterly report from Google said that YouTube was now, I think, up to 40 minutes a day, the average watching span? That's huge. I know it doesn't sound like a lot. Well, if you watch 1 hour long TV show, you're watching more than that. The problem is that is a very big number, and it comes at the direct expense of television. You're already starting to see it, but the stock market finally realized it. Mostly because numbers are starting to come out that this is happening. This transition is happening faster than we thought. I'm glad about that. I'm happy for it because, frankly, the cable companies it's not a good deal. I don't want to use a stronger phrase, but it's not. I want to use a stronger phrase, but I can't. It's not a good deal. The cable companies are letting us have it. With these overpriced, how much do you pay now for your cable bill? Of course, the problem is if you get your internet from cable companies, notice something's happened over time. The cost of cord cutting compared to the cost of cable TV has been going up and up and up. The cable companies see this train coming, and they've been adjusting the cost of internet to the point where, it's a push. It's going to cost you the same. So right now, you don't do cord cutting for savings. If you pay, let's say you get HBO Now, right? That's what we call over the top. A lot of jargon in this. HBO Now doesn't require a cable subscription. HBO Go does. That's the other app. If you use HBO Go, you sign into your cable company. They verify that you pay for HBO Now. You can watch HBO. Or you pay $15 a month for HBO Now, and you don't need a cable subscription. Problem is, if you add the premium, how much do you pay for HBO on cable? Probably less than that. $10 a month? I don't know. Maybe more. I don't even like to look at my cable bill. In one way, this is good. It's competition. Another way, it's bad because prices seem to be going up overall. We are going through, as in so many industries now, thanks to technology and the internet, a complete sea change, a revolution in how business is done. And this is going to be a big one. Apple apparently has been negotiating. Apple really wants to make the Apple TV the ultimate cord-cutting device. They've been trying to get these deals with the television networks to put the local channels on the Apple TV, to put network programming on the TV. And, of course, everybody's reluctant. The networks don't want to make the cable companies mad because right now that's how they reach most people. They can't afford to tick off Comcast. Comcast might pull the plug on NBC, and then what would they do? So it's a difficult time for everybody. They're all navigating these tough waters. But ultimately, where we're headed, of course, is an infinite number of channels coming to your big screen TV over the internet. And that's why when we were talking last hour with Scott Wilkinson, our home theater guru, our expert on home theater, I said, it's nice. I'm sure there'll be a market for discs, for ultra-high-def discs and so forth among the video files, but it's going to be a tiny market because almost everybody else, remember, you're talking to a generation that thinks YouTube looks pretty darn good. Almost everybody else is going to be watching on the internet. That's where your content will come from, audio and video. Now, I'm going to pat myself on the back a little bit because I presumed this was going to happen 10 years ago when I started my company, Twit, which is an internet television company. It took us a while to get to TV, but that's what we're doing now, internet television. Because I fully expected this would I thought it happened a lot sooner, frankly. So I'm applauding. I want us to be able to get our content over the internet. I think there'll be a broader variety of content. It'll be more compelling. You'll get to choose what you want. It'll probably, in the long run, cost you less. We've got to get costs of internet access down, of course. And companies like Google are doing that, aren't they? Going into the market, competing, showing people, yeah, you can get gigabit Ethernet for less. Yeah, internet for less. We can do that. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. If you have a question, a comment, suggestion, if you want to talk about how you get your internet content. Jenny on the line from West Los Angeles. Hi, Jenny. You're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi.
Hey.
I told the screener that I really felt as if I'd won the lottery today, just getting it through.
Getting through is hard, I know, and then you have to hold on, and I apologize that it's so difficult.
Oh, no, it's okay. I'm trying to learn some things. Anyway, I'm a grandmother, and I have a granddaughter who's in college and has had a computer for quite a long time, and she says it's slow, it's almost dragging its feet. She's had it upgraded, whichever, I guess that means it gives it more memory. But she says she thinks it's time to get a new...
Yeah, you know what she's saying, Grandma. Can I have a new computer? I mean, I could tell you things that might help you. How old is the computer?
Her computer is at least 5 years old, maybe even 7.
Yeah, you could probably put Windows 10 on it, erase the hard drive, start over. Computers, especially Windows computers, slow down over time because there's all sorts of cruft that gets installed there. And the best thing to do is a spring cleaning, wipe the drive and start over. And Windows 10 is free to her. She probably has Windows 7 on her computer. So she could take advantage of this, do a clean install of Windows 10, get a new operating system. Everything would be faster. But I think she wants a new computer.
Yeah, so she's, I remember listening to you last week, and some mother called and said, is it time to tap grandma for the little better?
Yeah, that's right. She wanted to put, because there are a lot of cheap computers out there, but I told her a cheap computer is a fool's bargain. So hang on, we'll talk a little bit about what to do when we come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888-ASK-LEO. We were talking to Jenny in West L.A. Grandma's the one they go to when it's time for a new computer.
What? Oh, I guess so, but, it lasts her a long time.
Did she have a Windows machine or a Mac?
She's a Mac.
Oh, I apologize, because I gave you all this useless information. All right.
Well, I don't know. Last year, somehow she took the computer into the store and had it updated.
Oh, good.
Looking for more memory.
Yeah.
But now she says it's just tough.
Yeah, you know what? It is old for a Mac.
Yeah.
So I think it's time to get a new Mac. So
she was considering the Mac Pro or the Mac Air, and she tried last week to get in, but it's impossible to get on your line.
Well, I'm glad you got through.
Thank you.
Grandma used her magic dust. Her magic fairy godmother dust to get through.
I really felt lucky.
So the difference between a MacBook, I presume you mean a MacBook Pro or a MacBook Air. She wants a laptop, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Besides price, which is significant, the difference really that she'd notice immediately is the screen. The MacBook Airs are not Retina yet. So that means that their screens are lower resolution. And the chief benefit to the MacBook Air right now is it's very light and thin. Unfortunately, you're gonna be mad when you buy it because she needs it for school, right? She needs it soon.
Right, she's in college.
Yeah, because Apple's going to release new ones, I think, any minute now. But not in time for you, probably more like October.
Oh, well, I don't know.
If you can talk her into saying, hey, can you struggle for a few more months? Because there's going to be a big update. And it will be faster, better battery life. It really will be worth waiting for. And the good thing about Apple is they don't raise the price. They just improve performance.
Mm-hmm.
Intel's new chips were just announced. And these new chips are going to be shipping for some machines soon, but will be out in October for the laptops. And I expect that's where it is, the ninth generation, I think, or 10th. I can't even keep track anymore. So these Skylake processors have a few things. This is probably more detail than you even care about.
Oh, I'm willing to learn.
I'm going to really, really tell you way too much. But some people are interested in this. So Intel is does processors. And by the way, that's what's in the Macintosh. It's what's in all computers these days. Intel does what's called a tick-tock development cycle. On the tick, they reduce the die size. So they're now down to 14 nanometers. So they're down to really, really tiny wires. That's good because it means faster, lower heat, better all around. We're on the tock now. The next one, the Skylakes, will be faster, the same 14 nanometer process, but faster, better battery life. And in some cases, 30% battery life. And that's for a student a big deal.
Yes.
I expect Apple will also push out, finally, because Intel's graphics are going to be much improved with the Skylakes, will finally put out a Retina display for the MacBook Air. So I think that the next, there's going to be a fairly big upgrade, I guess, is what I'm saying, to Apple laptops in the fall.
Huh? Boy, they sure could have come out before school started.
That yeah.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to go wrong. What does she use it for? Writing papers, mostly, stuff like that?
I probably, and research, and I don't know all the things. She would have loved to have talked to you in person.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, she's getting information. I mean, the MacBook Pros are faster, more expensive, but faster, heavier, better screens, worse battery life. So if battery life and lightness, if portability is paramount, then you'd go with a MacBook Air. If performance and screen quality are paramount, then you'd go with a MacBook Pro.
Okay, so what's the new one that's coming out?
It'll be a MacBook Pro or a MacBook Air, I expect, but they will be faster, better. They'll be about we're looking at 20 to 30% improvements in speed. We're looking at about a 30 to 40% improvement in battery. So these things will be significantly better if she can wait until October or November. The problem is Apple is unpredictable, and they might wait till January, in which case it wasn't worth waiting.
Right. What's the price differential?
The prices are always the same. So what Apple does is...
I mean, between the Pro and the Air.
Oh, the differential. Well, you can see that if you go to Apple.com, you can actually compare them. The starting point for a MacBook Air is $1,000. The one that you probably want to buy is going to be probably $1,299. Let me look real quickly. That's the one with $899. Oh, they've changed it. The 11-inch is $899. The 13-inch is $999. I would tell her to get a 13-inch. 13-inch has 12 to 13 hours of battery life, which is nice. You can get an i5 processor, kind of the standard stock base model. Let me look. They've changed their website a little bit. And they took the store out, and we have to do it now here. The 13 inches on the MacBook Air starts at $999. I think that's a good choice for a student. That's what I gave my son when he went to college. I think that's a pretty good price.
You're thinking the Air is better because it's got
it's lighter.
Cheaper, it's lighter.
Yeah.
But you say the resolution isn't quite as good as the Pro.
Right. The Pro, a comparable Pro is going to be about $300 more.
Okay.
It's not a huge differential.
Okay.
So, in fact, you can now do a comparison on the site. So I'm going to look at a 13-inch MacBook Air, $999. 13-inch MacBook Pro, $1,299.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them have an i5 processor. Both of them have the same amount of memory. Well, you can put a little more memory in the MacBook Pro.
More memory. Yeah, that's
memory. Better. Memory does make a difference in performance. If you can afford, be honest with you, if you can afford a few hundred bucks more, and speed isn't critical for her, I would say the middle of the line for the MacBook Pro, which is a 13-inch with 256-gig hard drive, is $1,500. That's a little pricey. 10 hours battery life. A comparable MacBook Air is going to be maybe $1,100. So it's about $300 difference.
Okay, so you get the 256. What is that, gigabytes? Or what is
that's the storage. That's the hard drive. She's going to want 256. 128 is a little light. She's frankly going to want You know, you can't put 8 gigs of RAM on the MacBook Air. So if she needs, you know, this kind of comes down to, I wish I could talk to her, because this kind of comes down to what they're going to have her be doing. If she were doing 3D design or photography, what's her major?
It's fashion merchandise.
Oh, nice. She might be doing drawing and stuff. Get her the MacBook Pro.
Okay.
Seriously, the resolution of the display is going to make a difference to her. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Oh, and go to the education store, by the way. You'll save some money. That big old jet airliner has flown in and deposited Johnny Jet, our travel guru, from johnnyjet.com, at Johnny Jet on Twitter and Instagram. Hey, Johnny, you're at home.
Yes, I am. I'm back in Los Angeles.
I think you are flipped from us. We travel to go on vacation. You go home to go on vacation.
It's true. I'm very excited to be home this week. I just told my wife, she came in last night. I came in the day before. And I said, I'm actually more excited about her being here this week than us on our next trip.
Home is your vacation. I just realized that, because when you're traveling, you're working.
Yeah.
Nice job if you can get it, I have to say. You're going on a river cruise next week?
I am. I usually don't tell people where I'm going, but you drive
You don't have
it
to say where. You don't have to say where. There are many rivers.
There are many rivers.
Many rivers to cross.
I'm actually going on a big trip. I'm going around the world.
No, you're no, you cannot. That's no. You have to retire to do that. That's my goal in life.
Well,
I'm saving
ship,
up for around the world. You're not going on a ship. You're going on a plane?
Around the world, yeah.
That's nice. Are you getting now? Apparently, there's some companies sell passes, right?
There are. I mean, these days, I always tell people, by the way, if you're going to do a big trip like from, you know, the States to Africa or Asia or Australia, look at around the world ticket, because sometimes it's actually cheaper than point A to point B. And so I'm just going to make multiple stops.
How long is it going to take you to go around the world?
A couple weeks. Wow. I actually have a couple in the next 2 months.
You're going around the world twice?
Yeah.
Jeez.
It's all work. I mean, it's work.
No, yeah, you could say that all you want. What is the different airlines?
Oh, yeah.
Which airlines?
That I can't tell you.
Ah! I want to go, and if you do this, I'm going to be really mad. Emirates has like a cabin on the plane.
Well, like they have
an apartment.
Etihad is the one with the suite.
Etihad has a suite.
Etihad,
right,
out of Abu Dhabi. But Emirates has a shower, and has two showers in first class.
You get a shower.
And you get 5 minutes. I have yet to have that
privilege.
Wait a minute.
They have a timer?
Yeah, 5 minutes.
Wow. I guess you don't want to kind of live in the shower.
Well, water weighs so much. Yeah. So, I mean, they have to.
So every time that Johnny joins us, he has two things for us. Because his whole thing is traveling better using technology. One is a website. One is an app.
Yep. And actually, I think we should add three. We should do a tip a day.
I love it. Deal.
All right, so my first one is, since I'm doing this big trip, I was looking for an app that would show me what the tipping is in each country that I'm going to. I'm going to multiple countries. And, you know, it's tough to remember exactly what the customs are, and you don't want to offend anyone, especially in Japan. They don't tip and things like that. So this one, unfortunately, is only for iOS. It costs 99 cents. It's called Global Tipping.
Oh, I need this. We do this.
But what I like about
it, we were never sure what the rules were, you know, what country.
Yeah, so when you're going to multiple countries, it's good to have an app, especially if you forget to research before. I mean, you can always Google it.
Yeah, we Googled it, but it's hard to find what you need.
But what I like about this app is that it has, you know, over 150 countries, from Afghanistan to Zimbabwe. You can also it shows you the right amount for restaurants, hotels, taxis, porters. And if you're having dinner with multiple people or lunch, you can split the tab and shows you exactly how much each person should pay. Nice. And what I like, because I don't drink alcohol, that'll tell you the difference between drinkers and non-drinkers.
You're paying for that bottle of wine. You know you are.
Well, I remember I used to go out to dinner with my friends in New York, and I didn't drink, and I had no money back then. And they would all order
and the bill
everything.
Goes through the roof because of the booze. Yeah.
I would have a $20 meal, and I'd have to pay $100.
No, not fair. It's not right. You shouldn't have to subsidize somebody else's vices.
Exactly.
Now, let me ask you this about tipping, because sometimes they say it would be an insult. In some countries, it would be an insult if you tipped.
It is in Japan.
Yeah, well, I've never, you know, I got to say this. If you, I've never seen anybody say, no, That is an insult. I am insulted. No, they take the money.
Yeah.
They're not that insulted.
In Japan, they would never do that. But they would just they would politely decline it.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. That's good. I'm going to Japan.
So.
Because here in the States, they just don't pay anybody, and everybody lives on tips. So I always over tip because I feel like
here you got to tip 20%.
I used to work in, you know, I used to work as a waiter, as we used to work in a service. I know it. You get nothing.
Right.
So I always, I always do 20, at least 20%. Right. All right. That was your app.
All right. So here's my website. It's called Exit, E-X-I-T, Fares, FARES/deals.
ExitFares/deals.
ExitFares.com/deals.
Yeah.
So what I like about this site, first of all, I pride myself on trying to find the best deals out there, and I scour every website out there and sign up to all these different newsletters. And this is what these guys basically do. They're kind of like my competition.
You're giving a plug to the competition, Johnny.
Because they do a good job, and I find some deals off of them, then I put them in my newsletter.
Yeah, subscribe. Johnny's newsletter is free, so why not get both?
That's right. So, but as you can see, there's some good deals right here. New York to Dublin for $549 round trip. Airfare Watchdog, they have a deal from those guys. L.A. to D.C. for $226 round trip on United.
Wow.
Some of them you need to be a little bit careful of because I see one of them, if you scroll down a little bit more, actually right there, $74 L.A. to Dallas on Spirit. Although it says $74, Spirit is not going to – you're not going to end up paying $74.
Don't bring any – they charge you for carry-on.
Yes.
And they have this the narrowest seat widths, narrowest least legroom of any airline.
29.
Yeah. If you're tall, don't go on Spirit. But this is cool. But so if you need to a little bit know what you're doing, probably some of these have multiple stops, right? They're not one stop, no stops and all that stuff.
For sure. Not all of them, but most of them would. But still, I mean, if you want to get to Asia for $500.
Yeah. Pretty neat.
I mean, I'm actually
have you ever taken advantage of these kind of things?
For sure. Actually, my trip next week, I bought a dollar fare on American Airlines.
No. Wow.
It was – their fare is $1, and then I had to pay taxes because I'm going through London.
Yeah.
And it was, $230 or whatever
that's
it is.
Amazing.
But still.
That's amazing.
You can find deals. You just need to sign up to the different newsletters. And when that came out, I was really writing about it.
ExitFares.com/deals.
That's that one.
And so your tip.
My tip is so if you're going on a trip like this or if you're going out of the country, make sure you call your credit card company before you leave. I recommend not doing it on the web. My wife did it on the web on hers, and you know, her card got declined. And then she called up and said, "What's going on?" And the bank said, "It's better to call." So I always recommend calling.
I called USAA. They said, "Do it on the web." So I did it on the web. And then I called American Express and said, "Don't call us. We don't need to know that." So everybody's got different. But you know what? You're absolutely right. The worst thing is your ATM card, because if you're counting on getting cash in the foreign denominations and you get declined, that could be a real problem.
So call your bank and your credit card company.
Find out what the limit is too, because there's a limit on how much cash you can take out.
And make sure your code is 4 digits.
Make sure your code is 4 digits? Why is that?
Because some in America, they use their zip code as their
That might cause a problem.
Well, and usually overseas, you can only do 4 digits.
4 digits
max.
Okay.
So,
and nowadays we're all getting pinned cards with chips in them, which is a good thing because that makes it a little easier to use them overseas.
Without a doubt.
JohnnyJet.com. Yeah, thank goodness we got the chips.
The EMV chips.
Yeah.
And the best one, by the way, is Barclaycard, because they are pin capability. So most of the cards right now that are coming out are
chip and sign.
But you want chip and pin.
Chip and pin, Barclay. And then also inquire about international fees, because they can
was what I was going to say. Make sure you get no foreign transaction fees. And they're starting to come out. Actually, American Express, one of their bloggers, by the way, this week they just came out with no foreign transaction fees. I love the Starwood card. It's great, but I didn't use it overseas because they would charge you 3%. Now, this week, they're coming out with no foreign transaction fees.
And you get the points, and you can stay at the Starwoods.
That's
JohnnyJet.com. Follow him on the Twitter and the Instagram. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls right after this. So, it's so hard to figure out who charges fees and who doesn't charge fees. It's not easy to figure that out.
Well,
I'm sure it's written somewhere.
Many websites out there that do it.
Oh.
The best ones for travel are usually Starwood America Express now because of the no foreign transaction fees.
Okay.
But the Barclay card is awesome, and the Chase Sapphire people love.
I have a Chase. Oh, no. Lisa has a Chase Sapphire. That's no. I'll have to tell her that. That's good. She should use that when she travels.
But, I mean, most of these travelers, they have tons of the different. I have 10 different cards, but I only use a few when I'm traveling.
Okay.
But you sign up to them so you get large amounts of miles.
I'm getting a new wallet because I have so many cards. No, I actually want to cut down on cards. I want to get rid of cards. Fewer cards.
So I got a quick question for you.
Yes, sir.
Netgear just sent me this. A round town 4G LTE hotspot. Internet.
Yeah. Nice.
So tell me what the difference of this between having the hotspot on my phone.
Usually they're faster. It's the same. The fees are usually built into the phone bill, so you're probably paying $20 or $30 a month if you're going to use your phone as a hotspot. But you should check because it may be cheaper to use a I call those MiFi generically, but
right.
They're also, my experience, much faster than the phone. For some reason, phones, maybe there's overhead or something. But you should do a speed test and see. But my experience has been that the phones are not as fast as the standalone
right.
Wi-Fi access points. That also has another advantage, which is it's a router. So it's for security purposes, probably more secure than using your phone.
Okay.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. Dave is on the line, Riverside, California. Hi, Dave.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling. What can I do for you?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, you were talking about Microsoft introducing a new service that opted in the end user to allow Microsoft access to your personal files in case the government or...
I was a little overzealous, and I'm so glad you called about that. Because I got swept away in by some of the posts I'd read, and then I went back and reread the EULA. So a number of people, including our security expert who comes on the show from time to time, Steve Gibson, says, I'm never going to use Windows 10 ever because of these features. But what Microsoft is doing is exactly what everybody else is doing. When you put stuff on the internet, they have control of that stuff, and should law enforcement ask them, they have no choice, as long as they're appropriately asked with a court order, a subpoena, a warrant, they have no choice but to give that information to the government. So in that respect, Microsoft is right to disclose that. I think it's good that they say that. But I don't know if it's a real cause for concern. I overstated the case. I don't think, although we don't have evidence one way or the other, but I don't think Microsoft has a way to reach into your personal computer and get stuff off your hard drive.
Well, my concern was kind of the opposite. If they actually did have that ability, let's say you became an enemy of the state for whatever reason, and they wanted to plant something on your computer.
Yeah. You know what? If I'll be honest with you. Don't become an enemy of the state. Because all bets are off at that point, right? And we've seen many movies and TV shows, but I think it's the fact of the matter, and I think you can even look back to some historic incidents. We've finally seen the FBI dossier on Martin Luther King. They were following him. He was considered a terrorist because he was for civil rights, and J. Edgar Hoover didn't like that. So while we might laugh and say, oh, yeah, that's the Bourne identity, you can become an enemy of the state. And if you are an enemy of the state has resources far beyond that of mortal man.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I suppose.
But I mean, I think you're kind of in trouble if you're an enemy of the state, rightly or wrongly. I mean, look, there are people who have been enemies of the state. Remember Nixon's enemies list? People just the president didn't like. But at that point... The federal government, the United States government, has some pretty amazing resources at its disposal, including nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
So it's actually a great question. And, I was very interested to see the debate between Rand Paul, if you watch the GOP debate on Thursday, who was really adamantly defending that, and Governor Christie of New Jersey was saying, look, this is the fundamental debate. Governor Christie says, yeah, it's all well and good to say protect our privacy, but when we are at risk of terrorist action, do you want to be the guy who made that possible? And that's the debate in a nutshell. We have the Fourth Amendment. In fact, it's the not only a fundamental part of the Bill of Rights, but it's a lot of the reason why we even have a republic here, is because they didn't like George III's search and seizure. They didn't like the English troops coming into the house and searching without a warrant. So the Fourth Amendment is not an afterthought. It's very much a fundamental part of our Constitution, the right against illegal search and seizure. And I think Rand Paul's right. We are right now violating that right. On the other hand, Christie makes an excellent point. Do you want to be safe or not? And this is the national debate that's raging right now. What Microsoft is saying is, look, the law of the land is such right now that if they want that information and we have it, we have to give it to them. So the question one must ask is, well, what does Microsoft know and what doesn't know? What does Google know? What don't they know? What does Apple know? And what don't they know? And I think that if you really want to be safe, especially if you're putting stuff on the internet, or if there is internet access to your stuff, you need to encrypt.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And I think if you're concerned that you're going to become an enemy of the state, you have my sympathies, because we've got Guantanamo. I mean, the state has a lot of power, doesn't it?
Well, I just don't trust the state anymore.
I completely understand. And after some of the revelations of Edward Snowden, I'm with you. Actually, the stuff that Snowden told us, we knew. A lot of that, we knew.
Yeah.
But it was easy to pretend it wasn't going on.
Thank you, Leo.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I don't want to – I mean, let's not get tinfoil hats on here. I don't think currently – our federal government is targeting people. Well, I can't even say that, really, can I? I don't know what to say. Don't become an enemy of the state. Keep your head down. Encryption is a good thing to learn about. Encryption, strong encryption, trust the math is what security experts say. Strong encryption relies on solid mathematical principles that make it virtually impossible for even a state actor with lots of resources to get your stuff. But using encryption is difficult. It's inconvenient. It makes it difficult to communicate with others. Good encryption exists. There was a little concern. I saw an article, I think, in the Register, because there is a court case going on right now. I'll have to get the details for you, in which the federal government's brief said we were able to get into somebody's hard drive encrypted with TrueCrypt, an encryption technology I've told you about and we trust and have trusted for a long time. But what they don't make clear is how they got into TrueCrypt. I don't believe there's a government backdoor or way of decrypting TrueCrypt. I believe that was a case where they got the password. They just didn't say it, but they got the password from the defendant. I've been told that. I've spoken to the Secret Service and the FBI about forensics, and one of the things I think it was the Secret Service told me is, you know, the bad guys almost always give you the password surprisingly easily. Sometimes it's not that's probably the best route, so just ask. 8888 Ask Leo, that's the phone number. I don't know what to say. I mean, it's good for us to be aware and informed on these issues, and it's a reasonable debate to have. Do we want to be safe? Do we want to be private? Is there a middle ground that can give us a little bit of both? Tim is in Moore Park, California. Hi, Tim.
I love you, Leo. I'm Tim Callum Carrion. How do I get free, private, anonymous email that does not read my email like Start Mail, but free? Start Mail is StartMail. It doesn't read your email, but it costs $55 a month, a year.
Well, you know why Google and Yahoo and Microsoft read your email? They need to pay for this. Well, but that's how they pay for it. So a free service, if you think about it, it costs somebody something to give you an email service. They've got to pay for servers. They've got to pay for bandwidth. They've got to pay for support. It's not free to them. That's why Google Mail, which looks like it's free, isn't free. They pay for it with advertising, and they read your email to provide you with advertising. I have to take a break. Stay on the line. When we come back, let's see if we can find a way to get free email that doesn't spy on you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Our show today brought to you by Epson. I love Epson. Did you see? This isn't actually in their ad copy, but did you see what Epson's going to do? They're going to eliminate ink cartridges, which is nuts because for years, this is how printer companies made money. They would sell you a cheap printer and then charge you an arm and a leg for the ink. Epson, I have to give them credit, has never done that. In fact, I had an Epson photo printer that had reservoirs and you put the ink in it. It was awesome. I love Epson. Their new workforce printers, I have them everywhere. We installed one here for Lisa. I have one at home. I replaced all my Epson printers because I've had the Workforce Pro for years, but these new ones are powered by something called Precision Core. You got to check it out. This comes from the industrial printer side. And these new nozzles that they created for high-speed industrial presses, 40 million dots per second. 40 million dots per second. Precisely, exactly right amount of ink. And as a result, now that they've brought this down to the Workforce series, I'm getting incredible speeds. It's faster than laser. It's lower cost than laser. It is an inkjet printer, but the cost per page is about half that of a color laser printer. Epson's knocking it out of the park. I love this company. I love their printers. I've been using them as photo printers for years. The Workforce series is for the small business, the home office, and it's why I have it at home. I use it to make copies, color copies, to scan. Scans over the network, prints over the network. It's efficient. It's fast. You'll cut costs without compromising quality, and you'll keep your business moving forward. And by the way, unlike laser printers, there's no warm-up time. You could print on a wide range of media, including labels, which is great. They're very energy efficient. It's the next generation of inkjet performance. And if you haven't seen the Workforce at work, you've got to. Go to Epson.com today and find out what the new Workforce printers can do for you and your business. E-P-S-O-N, Epson.com. I love my Epson printer at home. By the way, I can print to it from here too, because it's Google Cloud print enabled. It's AirPrint enabled, prints over the network. So I can literally send a print job to it from here. I can also scan to my Google Drive. I mean, these are brilliant. Performance beyond laser, great software, the best printing technology available today. Epson.com, built to perform. Epson. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet. Smartphones, smart watches, home theater, digital photography, anything with a chip in it. 8888 Ask Leo's the phone number. The website is techguylabs.com. Before the break, Tim called in with a great question. He says he's used StartMail, but StartMail's $60 a year. StartMail claims to offer secure email. He says, where can I get a free version of the same? Couple of things I'd say. First of all, anything that's free on the internet, be suspicious. It unless they've got some billionaire just giving them money, either they're going out of business. There are a lot of free things on the internet. Most things on the internet are free. Or they have a plan to monetize in some way. Servers aren't free. Bandwidth's not free. That great-looking website's not free. Engineers are very expensive. So there's got to be a plan somewhere to pay for all that. It worries me when something says, oh, no, we're free and we're not going to show you ads and we're not going to monetize you. Well, then I'm worried that they're hiding something because, well, as the great science fiction author Robert Heinlein once said, Tinstoffel, there is no such thing as a free lunch. You know, what's going on? Now, there is a service to answer your question, Tim, and the chat room reminded me of this, and I set up an account on this for a while back, and I'm not advocating it only because I don't quite understand it. There is a Swiss company called Proton Mail. It's Proton, P-R-O-T-O-N, Mail, M-A-I-L, .ch. That's the Swiss domain that says they provide everything you asked for, end-to-end encryption, secure email servers not in the United States, where they would be subject to U.S. law, but in Switzerland. It's 100% free, they say, and modern and stress-free. So, of course, immediately I wonder, well, huh? Is this a pro bono effort? Who's paying for this? It says, we are scientists, engineers, and developers drawn together by a shared vision of protecting civil liberties online. That maybe is possible. I mean, certainly open source software is often created by people who do it for free just for the public good or for their own, you know, satisfaction. So this is I guess it's possible. There's a team, though. I'm seeing a total of 11 people working for them. Ah, here's a part of the page that might be interesting. ProtonMail is supported by more than 10,000 individuals who participated in our crowdfunding campaign. Well, that's good. They raised money. Additional backers include, wait a minute, Charles River Ventures. That's a venture capital fund. As far as I know, venture capitalists usually expect a payout of some kind. The Fondation Genevoise pour l'Innovation Technologique, or FONGIT, which is a nonprofit, financed by the Swiss government. Okay. But let's presume the Swiss government gives them money without any expectation. You know, the problem is, how do you verify that this is secure, safe, and nobody's watching? You can't. You just have to say, well, it's a nice website. Looks like must be true. They got a picture of the Swiss Alps. Must be true because the Swiss never lie. It's got to be true. You're just trusting them. Here's my suggestion. If you want really, truly secure and private email and you don't want anybody to read it, there is, in my mind, one and only one absolutely sure and safe and secure and verifiable way to do that, and that is to encrypt it yourself, to scramble it yourself. The only way to put something on the internet that's private is if you scramble it before it goes on the internet. And you and only you keep the key. Now, they have encryption, but they have the key, so that's not going to, that doesn't fly. You have to do it. You have to download, I would recommend, an open source version of PGP called GPG, GNU Privacy Guard. There's GPG for Windows, and there's GPG for Mac. It's free because it's open source, and you can inspect the source, and people had to make sure there's no backdoor for governments. You then generate your own private key pair. You're going to have a public key and a private key. The public key you can give out. Anybody can have it. In fact, you should give it out. I put my public key in my email signature. You could put it on the key servers so people can find it. That's what they need to send you private mail. They use GPG to encrypt what they're sending to you. And you have the private key. You keep that close to your vest because that's what you need to decrypt. So this public key crypto really is a great idea. You can give out your public key without any harm. That allows people to send you private email. And then you have your private key that you keep under lock and key, password protected, so that nobody can get it. And then you can look at mail. You could do the same thing using public key cryptography for your data, anything you store on the internet. That, in my mind, that's the only way. But then if you do that, you can use Gmail because Google can't read your mail. It's just gobbledygook. And by the way, they don't prohibit this. In fact, Google's been looking in a way to do this, but there's always going to be an issue with when they hold the key. You know, you and only you should have that private key. So download GNU Privacy Guard, gpgtools.org on the Mac, gpg, the number 4, windows.com on the PC. Install it. It's safe. It's secure. Generate a strong key pair, 2048 or 4096 bits, really strong. Even the government can't crack that. And use it. You have to prearrange with people you're going to email that they get your public key so they can send you stuff, and you get their public key so you can send them stuff. That's not so hard. There's a way to do that. And now you can exchange email that nobody, not even the government, can read. And you can do it on a free email service like Gmail. So if you want to, if you believe in Proton Mail and you trust them, and I have no reason not to, but I have no reason to, then go ahead, go out and get that. That's free, protonmail.ch. It's certainly a lot easier. But if you really care and you don't want anybody to read your mail and you don't want anybody to do advertising against your mail, you can only, and by the way, you won't be able to send mail to anybody except people you've already got their public key. Like if you decide you want to send an angry email to Captain Crunch, you can't. You know, or somebody will be able to read that email. But if you want private email, in my opinion, if you want private internet access of any kind, if you want to be private in the internet, the only way to do it is something called end-to-end encryption, where only you hold the public key. And other than that, you're just trusting. You're just trusting somebody in Switzerland. Well, they're Swiss. They've got to be trustworthy. Seems like they do everything right. I have no reason not to trust them. They seem pretty good. They claim to use end-to-end encryption, which is good. I'll have to read up on how they're doing that. You'll know if it's good encryption if only you have your private key. If they make a private key for you and keep it on their website, that's not the same. That's not what I'm talking about. You need to make your own key and keep it to yourself. No, if anybody has access to your private key, you're not private anymore. You have to create a new one. 8888 Ask Leo. Somebody in the chat room saying, well, I don't get it. Why can't anyone with your public key read the email again? Oh, it's because it's one-way encryption. Your public key only encrypts. It doesn't decrypt. It's quite a clever thing. Once this was created, remember, this is the encryption the federal government tried to block from export, saying this is munitions quality. This is dangerous. Well, they gave up on that, and it is global, and thanks to the guy who invented it, Phil Zimmerman, and PGP, or not invented it, but made it popular, we can all use it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Ah, so Proton Mail is full. Well, that's what happens when you're giving something away. They say they've reached their server limit and will send an invite when they build more servers. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. Should mention one thing. The NSA has said if we see encrypted email flying back and forth, regardless of whether it's from a United States national or an international sender, we assume that you are up to no good and we save those emails. So it is a red flag. You're saying, yeah, I'm encrypting my email. The good news is, as far as we know, there's no way for them to unencrypt it. If you've used a strong key, that's why you want a long 4,096-bit key and a good password, you'll be all right. But it does kind of alert the authorities. 8888 Ask Leo, that's the number. Paul in Los Angeles, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I was wondering if there is a free alternative to Google Voice.
That's a good question. Google Voice is, to my knowledge, the only free. Some have free trials or free limited capabilities and so forth. But I don't know if I don't know of any, because it's expensive. This is, again, a case of, in order for somebody to give you these kinds of services, they have to have fairly elaborate systems, including access to the public phone system, which costs them money. So I don't know of anything that's free. It's amazing that Google's been giving this away for free.
Right. I'm finding that Google is running out of numbers in my area.
Ah, that's frustrating. That's one of the costs, by the way, is getting numbers. Google Voice is, I think, a great service. Google bought a company called Grand Central, which was doing this as a paid service for a long time, and made it a free service. You get a number, a Google Voice number, which is your ultimate number that you give out. I have one. I give it to everybody. But then you can control it using Google Voice as to what happens when people ring that number. You can send it automatically to voicemail if you want. You can say some numbers go to voicemail, unknown numbers go to voicemail. You can say if it's from a family member, I want them to get this this message. If it's not, I want them to get this message. You can do all sorts of great stuff. You can have one number ring up to five different phones. That's the main reason I started using Google Voice, is because I'm always testing phones. My phone number changes all the time. I have two phone numbers with each of the major carriers in the U.S. That's eight phone numbers. And I can't expect anybody to know which number I'm using at any given time. So I give them my Google Voice number, and then I set it up to ring the phone that I'm carrying. All of this is great. Google has kind of undermined it a little bit. They've started a phone service called Google Fi, Project Fi. And if you sign up for that and use it, you lose your Google Voice number becomes your actual phone number. And some of the features of Google Voice are disabled. The phone forwarding continues, but all of that fancy stuff. You know, one of the things I love about Google Voice is you can say screen all calls. If you call my Google Voice number, it says, "Who's calling?" They record their voice, and then I get a message before I pick up saying, "Joe's calling, you want to answer?" And I say yes or no based on that. All of these are great features. I don't know if anybody, does anybody know of anybody offering this for free? Lots of companies offering paid services that do this. Our sponsor, RingCentral, for instance. I used Grasshopper for a long time. They're paid. I just signed up for a service I haven't quite figured out called Anvio. That has a lot of phone numbers, not too expensive. In fact, I got a really good number because I looked through their database for numbers. But you pay for that too. Because they have to. It's expensive to do what they're doing. Google does it for free, like everything Google does, because then they can advertise to you. Although to date, they've not put any advertisements on anything Google Voice does. So nobody in the chat room knows of a way to do this for free.
How do you spell Anzio, Leo?
A-N-Z-E-O. They're A-N-Z-E-O. Complicated, but they're very sophisticated. It's worth looking to see if a number you want. I got such a good number. You know, one of those numbers you'll never forget. Which is that right? I'm sorry, Anvio. I'm thinking of Anzio. Anzio Beach. A-N-V-E-O.com.
Okay, thank you.
And they're pretty sophisticated, but very intriguing. Another good one is Grasshopper. Text Plus offer. Yeah, see, free calling isn't what we're talking about, I presume. Free calling is not the best feature of Google Voice. It is one of the features. You can call internationally very inexpensively. But I presume you want the phone handling capability. This is a complicated setup on Anvio, and I have still yet to figure it out, which is a shame because I love this number. And I want it to be. I'm worried about Google Voice. I signed up for Google Fi, and now I've lost some of the capabilities, and I'm worried that Google isn't really committed to Google Voice. You know how Google is. They tire and they move on. Scott, Hesperia, California, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. Yeah. Just have a couple of questions. With Windows 10, you've mentioned the need to back up before you do it, which is obvious.
That's just prudent. I haven't had to. I've never had any problems, but it's prudent.
Yeah. But I want to do more than that. I also want to create an image or a clone. And that's
good idea.
My first question. Is there a difference between an image or a clone?
Well, in most of the time when people use these, they use them interchangeably. The idea is to create a single file that is the contents of a hard drive in such a way that you can quickly restore it to that drive and the drive will be exactly as it was before. And that is a great thing to have. Now, of course, one of the things you can do if you have Windows 7 or 8 is make a recovery disk, and that'll let you get back to the way it was. But you want something, I think, more useful, which is an exact clone of your existing hard drive so that you can quickly restore it if things shouldn't go well.
Yeah, you have said on when you used to do the old screensavers that you would make.
Yeah.
You'd make one of those, and before the commercial was over, you'd be right back up.
Yeah, imagine, so we're doing a live television show in which we're messing with the computer like crazy, installing stuff and things. What if it crashes, as it sometimes did? Well, our builds for all of the PCs on the set, this is, remember, 1998 to 2004, is a while ago, was two hard drives in each PC. One hard drive, the one we're using, the boot drive. The second hard drive has one and only one purpose. It's storing the image of the original hard drive so that should it crash, in the 5 minutes that we have during a commercial break, we could run, in this case, we were using Norton Ghost, We could run Ghost and restore it, and we'd be back up and running before the commercials were over.
Yeah. Now, my limited experience trying to do that, it's never that fast reinstalling. It's horribly slow. Now, part of it absolutely has to be because I'm using just a USB external drive.
Oh, yeah, that's part of the slowness. Having it internal makes it a lot faster.
Okay. So back to the first question then. An image and a clone are essentially the same thing, or is one better than the other?
I think they're colloquially the same thing. I don't know if there's a technical difference between an image and a clone. An image of the drive is an exact bit-for-bit copy of the drive, and it's set up in such a way you can restore it. There are a number of programs, Acronis True Image, CloneZilla is free and open source, Macrium Drive Snapshot.de, Drive Imager, Ease US. Tell you what, we got a long list. Put them all in the show notes. TechGuyLabs.com. Some are free, some are paid, but they all do essentially the same thing. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. G. Scott, nice to talk to you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy from Minnesota.
Hey, Leo, how are you doing
today? I'm well, G. Scott. How are you?
I am good. Hey, I wanted to first thank you for the Note 4 backup after hearing Barry's call, the first guy there. I backed mine up, got my stuff over. First day I did an unintended factory reset.
Oops.
But I was able to get her back.
Yay. Was that using the Android Device Manager? Or?
And I was on the MyCloud, the Verizon Cloud.
Oh, good. Yeah, all the carriers are doing this now, which I think is smart. It's also a revenue point for them. They'll let you back up your phone to their cloud servers.
Yeah, like so that worked out.
Yep.
But my question for today, though, is I've got a client. I don't know if you remember, I install septic systems, northern Minnesota, and we can have freezing issues. And these guys want to remotely monitor their home, alarms in general.
Ah.
And they're kind of in the Apple environment. I'm a Windows guy, so I don't know if there's something specific to Apple that would help them out, but they'll have internet full-time at their remote cabin here and then want to be able to look at it when they're in Minneapolis or Florida or wherever they may be.
They want to monitor a camera, or do they want temperature sensors, moisture sensors, other kinds of sensors?
I think they're going to have something where there will be inputs to something that will tell them if the septic doesn't work, that'll tell them. Or if the house is too cold, if the furnace goes off, it'll tell them.
First thing I'd think of is our sponsor, SmartThings.
SmartThings.
Yeah, they're owned by Samsung now, which is, I think, a good thing. They were a Kickstarter project that went ballistic. The idea is they have an iPhone app. They also have an Android app. They even, I think, have a Windows phone app. And they have a hub, which you would put in the cabin in the house. And then that hub can talk wirelessly to a variety of sensors. The problem in home automation is that there's no standard. So there are a number of different, you know, you remember probably the X10 systems. That was one standard.
Yeah.
SmartThings does not work with X10, by the way.
Okay.
But there are more modern standards like Z-Wave and Zigbee. You need to find out from the homeowners if they have some sort of sensor using some sort of protocol like that. If
it's all new to them.
Okay.
So they don't have anything in existence right now.
Yeah, I would start, go to smartthings.com. They have a list of all the devices they support. What you probably want is a temperature monitor.
Okay.
That is in the ground.
Right.
It doesn't have to be in the pipe. I wouldn't want to put it in the pipe.
No.
Nothing would last in there very long.
Right. And like my alarm, I've got the ability to send a signal to whatever. So is there something
So you have your own alarm. How does it send a signal? What is the signal that it's sending?
It's 12 volt probably, or maybe 9 volt.
Ah, so it's a wired device.
Exactly,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting. So what you'd like is something that if the power goes high on a line connected to something, that it signals.
Right. It's basically a switch.
Yep.
And you know, I mean, my world is that septic pump, but they want to also, like I say, monitor if the power goes out, if anything happens, that they can get that notification, monitoring the temperature. So SmartThings looks like...
I would start with SmartThings. There's another company that makes a lot of these switches and so forth called Insteon. And they really have become a market leader here. They support Apple's HomeKit, because you could use Apple's HomeKit if the things you needed worked with it. Oh. That's why I like SmartThings is actually very clever. They realize that there's, you know, 800 languages.
Right.
So you make a hub that can speak to those devices, and then your phone speaks to the hub. So you only have one app on the phone that speaks to the hub. Hmm. I think that that would probably work, but you'd have to figure it out. And I can't help you much farther than a pointer. So SmartThings, there's also smarthome.com. They do the Insteon stuff.
Well, start with SmartThings.
I would look at SmartThings. Again, disclaimer, they're a sponsor, yeah. But they're owned by Samsung. They're I believe, about to refresh their entire line this fall. So there should be a whole bunch of new stuff going on with them. I think they're a really interesting company. And
I'll point them that way.
Yeah.
Give hey, me one other thing. Brian, yes, W. in the chat, he was wondering, you've got a deal you use in your motel room, a little VPN thing, if I recall. A little
I
white.
Do. Yeah.
What was the name of that?
If you go to Hotspot VPN, they sell a variety of different hardware devices that will integrate with their VPN service. Most of them, I have the one I have, you paid $99 for the hardware, you get a year VPN service. If you go to Hotspot VPN, they'll link over to tinyhardwarefirewall.com. That's a long number. But these things are fairly inexpensive. There are a variety of different ways they work. If you want a VPN, this is actually a very clever way to do it, hardware-based VPN.
Well, thanks again, Leo.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Thanks for calling. I appreciate it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Gizwiz Dick D. Bartolo coming up with a gadget of the week. He's always got some crazy stuff. Maybe he'll have something to do with a septic tank for us. Can you work on that, Dickie D? Joseph, Huntington Beach. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Joseph.
Hi. Oh, hi, Leo. Leo, a couple of one statement and one question I got for you, please.
Yes, sir.
The PGP.org that you mentioned is no longer in service.
Don't go to PGP. Go to GPG.
Oh.
So Google GPG. PGP's become a commercial service.
Yeah, it says that the domain is for sale.
Yeah, that's not the one. You want GNU, GNU Privacy Guard. And there are two different for Windows. It's very easy. It's a GPG for Windows. For Mac, okay, it's GPG Tools. This is what I use. It's GNUPG.org. That's where you can start. But but what you want is a simple installer that will install it. Are you on Windows?
Well, what I really wanted to use it for was using it on a tablet or my cell phone.
Yeah, that's a little bit more challenging because, unfortunately, there aren't really any good mobile solutions for encryption. There's there's a Mailvelope. There are a few. My experience has been that they're very hard to use. And this is the problem. I mean, I probably should give you the disclaimer whenever I talk about using encryption. One of the reasons more people don't use it is it's deucedly hard to use, especially on mobile. If you want private communications, your smartphone probably not the best place to start. A tablet maybe is okay, although, again, I don't know if tablet apps. GPG4WIN is a simple installer that will install it on Windows, and then your Windows email will use it. It's free and it's open source. And frankly, any encryption solution you're going to use, it's more convenient to use Microsoft's BitLocker or Apple's File Vault because they're built in and all that. But if it's not open source, there's really no way to verify that there's not a governmental backdoor or a flaw in it. Open source software for encryption is always the best way to go, in my opinion. 8888 Ask Leo. The Gizwiz coming up after this. Yeah, it's pretty much the computer owner's anthem. A man of constant sorrow. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. Keep that for future reference because I think we're pretty much done for the day. That's because I see the smiling face of Dick DiBartolo, Mad Magazine's maddest writer, man of constant humor. He's also our gadget guru. Hello, Dickie D.
How are you, sir?
I am well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you very much. It's so funny that you were talking about septic tanks because I have the USB septic tank light.
What?
No.
Okay, good.
Okay.
It could be used for many things.
And many things. So it's a book light, a keyboard light. I actually found out about this from Chad Johnson, who used it on the GizWiz.
OMG, Chad.
And he
Chad.
Had
yes.
a rechargeable version. And then I was searching on Amazon to buy what he showed. And I found an under $10 version
Whoa.
Of it. So it is twin LED lights. Each LED light is on a little gooseneck, so you can put it over two pages of a book. Ideal for lighting a keyboard at night. It's a little clip-on lamp. Each LED has a high-low switch. Basically, each arm has four LEDs. Each arm has two LEDs. You can click it once for one LED, click it twice for two LEDs. So in full illumination, you have four LEDs. It either runs on three AAA batteries. It comes with a cable, so it's USB. And it comes with the little AC adapter, so it can also run from the wall. And it's $9.99 and Amazon Prime. So I got in 2 days, and I actually use it for – I have a shelf on a desk that is not lit under the shelf. So I click this to the shelf, and I leave it on all the time, plugged into USB, and that way I can see what's at the back of my desk.
Actually, that would be very useful.
It is really neat. It's also great for an airplane, you know, if you want to be reading.
And, well, it's like the airplane lights that you get sometimes.
Yes, except it's right down where you really need it. Yeah, not 3 feet in the air.
What's the Amazon search so we can find
just go to gizwiz.biz, click on the tech guy.
That's the easiest thing. That's Dick's website, gizwiz.biz. I think you have a little cold, don't you?
I do.
I'm sorry.
Myra's sitting here in full hazmat gear.
Yeah. She's got a mask. You're supposed to wear a mask, not her.
Oh!
Go to gizwiz.biz. Click the GizWiz Visits the Tech Guy link. You'll find a link to the LED lights.
And that's the one that Chad showed, which comes with a little extra little flashlight. But the link to mine is at the bottom there where it says rechargeable light, $10.
Yeah. Oh, and that's a good deal. And I got to say, this whole remember the little itty bitty book light?
Yes, from Zelco.
And that burned out in about 5 seconds.
Yes.
Because they were incandescent bulbs. And now that we've got LEDs, this whole category has exploded.
Absolutely. Yeah, you will probably, we always talk about that. It's kind of sad to think that you just bought a light that is going to outlast your lifetime.
Wow, and this is $10. Super bright music stand light can be used.
It's one of those incredibly long Amazon things. Super bright.
Best
LED.
Suited for music stands, reading, barbecue, grilling. What? Desk can travel, used by musicians, readers, artists, chefs, fully portable, divine LEDs. Wow, that is a long name.
Yeah, no, and they left out septic tank.
It includes a USB plug in cable and a charger.
Yeah.
Actually, it should because it's a non-standard. The end is kind of a non-standard plug.
That's true. So that is correct.
You will need that special cable to use this. So, that's cool.
Yeah.
While you're at gizwiz.biz, don't forget the What the Heck Is It contest, a chance to win an autographed copy of Mad Magazine. All you have to do, we're getting almost to the
As a matter of fact, for the first time ever, you can see what you're winning.
Mad Hillary's Furious. Furious Road to the White House begins here. A little play on the Mad Max movie. That is awesome. Yes. Awesome. And all you have to do is identify whatever that slotted thing is. 12 autographed copies of Mad for the right answer, 24 for the wrong answer. And this is almost an IQ test, isn't it?
It is. Almost.
Almost. Gizwiz.biz. Don't forget gizwiz.tv for Dick's weekly podcast featuring many gadgets with the redhead himself, OMG Chad Johnson. And we will see you next week. Thank you, Dickie D.
I'll be back here.
Let's see if we get one or two more callers in here. Glenn from Roland Heights, California. Leo Laporte. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Leo.
Welcome.
Yes. Yeah, I'm trying to hook a TV up in the patio.
Okay.
To run off my DirecTV.
Okay.
In the living room with a splitter.
Yeah.
And my HDMI cable is about 50 feet.
Yeah, that's a little long for an a little long for an HDMI cable.
Okay, it works, but yeah, then within a minute you can barely see the screen. It's real dark.
And so you're not only are you sending it 50 feet, but you've got a splitter.
Yes.
So you're taking the signal, you're cutting it in half, and then you're letting it attenuate over a 50-foot. Now, in theory, it's a digital device, right? So digital signals aren't like electrical signals. They don't attenuate in the same way. You know, if it was a coaxial cable, you know, over a distance, the signal gets weaker and weaker. But that's actually not true on a digital signal. But what you do get is interference and weird echoes and ghosting, and because it's bouncing around in the cable and all sorts of stuff can happen to it. Usually, digital either works or doesn't work. It sounds like you're in the kind of a middle state where it's working. It's just not working well.
Right. Yeah, when I first turn the TV on, it works real good. But then within a minute, it's...
Yeah, that's a weak signal. Yeah. I think what's happening is it's dropping bits. Because it is digital. It's dropping bits. And so you're getting... Does this look a little stuttery sometimes?
Maybe a little bit.
Yeah. So what I would recommend is something called a Balun, or a Balun, B-A-L-U-N. What that does is it lets you send HDMI over an Ethernet cable. And it has amplifiers on both ends so that you can send it hundreds of feet without any degrading of the signal. It converts it to something that can go over Ethernet and then deconverts it back into HDMI. These are not expensive. If you look at monoprice.com for HDMI extenders and things like that, you should be able to find it. Or just B-A-L-U-N, you'll find it. And that it's a little pricey because you have to buy the transmitters on both ends. But it could get you a lot farther. Actually, you know what? It's not that pricey. Thank you, Monoprice. You're pretty amazing. $18.20, you provide the Ethernet cable, although that's not so hard to get. You do want to use high-quality cable, Cat 5E, or better yet, Cat 6. It's an interesting solution, and it really does the job. I've used them. So that's what you're going to look for. They call it an HDMI extender, but it is a Balun.
Okay.
All right?
Okay, I'll try that.
That'll solve the problem. One more. I think I'm one more. Let's do. I got one more in me. Alan, Los Angeles, Leo Laporte. I got 30 seconds, Alan.
Yay. The Note Galaxy 4, some of the reviews that came out in the beginning were horrible.
I love it. Highly recommend it. And in a week, they're announcing the Note 5.
Yeah, but you can't take the battery out and you don't
right.
have the SD.
I love the Note 4. It's still one of the best phones I've ever used. Highly recommend it. And you're right. It's better than the Note 5. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Have a great Geek Week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. I'm Leo Laporte. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, the Tech Guy is just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows now on the Twit Netcast Network, and you'll find them all at twit.tv. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on MacBreak Weekly, iPad on iPad Today. You get your daily dose of tech news from Tech News Today and our weekly roundtable show, This Week in Tech. It's all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next time with another great Tech Guy podcast. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.